Chinwag this morning with David Payne. I looked through David's CV. By goodness gracious me. Natal champion trainer 23 times. Champion South African trainer twice. South African trainer of the year. Got the trainer outstanding achievement 1980. Champion national apprentice jockey 1968-69. Won the McDonald Trophy at the South Australian Jockeys Academy in 1967. And trained the winners of over 100 individual Group 1 races in South Africa. The only person to ride and train a winner of South Africa's prestigious Group 1 Durban July Handicap. I tell you what, David, you got a few credits. Good morning.
Morning, because nice to live in the past.
Well, hey, it is nice. Look, it's nice to reflect back in the past. You're allowed to now and then.
Yeah, sure.
Gee, you had a terrific run there, didn't you?
Yeah, no, very fortunate. And you know, because it's when I was an apprentice, I actually ran away. And,
fair
Yeah, one of the stewards, the head steward, phoned my dad and said, "Can I come and see you?" So he said, "I want David to come back because I think he's got the making of a jockey." So took me back and took me under his wing, and that's history. So thanks to him, I might not have been here.
When you say ran away, what, so you shot through from the train or just said, "That's it, I'm not coming back"?
Yeah, I thought, "This is not that good, this guy, you know, not for me."
God, AWOL.
Yeah, duck.
Now, the interesting thing is, from what I can gather, you became a jockey simply because you were walking past the track. You used to see the horses. There was no racing in your family background, was there?
No, not at all. One of 10 children. We were quite a poor family. My dad was a bricklayer. So we had to walk about 3-4 k's to school every day. And we used to walk past the race course. And we used to peer through the picket fence and think, gee, this looks all right. And that's how I got interested. Never rode a horse in my life. Yeah, before that.
Do you remember your first day when you went to the races?
Yes. I had a ride. Wasn't much of a ride, but it was quite intimidating. You can still recall it, yeah.
But what about just even as a kid when your first day you actually went along as a spectator? That must have been so exciting. A door was open to you.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. It was sort of like a bug. It grabs you. So, and I was very small at that stage. I looked a natural, but unfortunately, I grew. And that's when I became a trainer.
Now, I'm going to mention the name of a horse, and I want to just hear your reaction to this, because I think it might bring back a few nice memories. Play.
Yes, that's my first winner. Yeah, and it was a dead heat. Yep.
Yeah, tell us about that day.
I weighed about 56 pounds. I was a little bloke. And quite a strong horse. And anyway, we went past the post, and with a jockey called Alan Taylor, senior rider, very, very good rider. And we both thought we'd won. So anyway, the number went up, was a dead heat. And funnily enough, on the same day, another apprentice rode his first winner as well. So it was quite a nice day.
Now, you mentioned that you're only like 56 pounds, which is nothing, really.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, I was tiny, absolute, yeah. I mean, you must, like I was going to be a natural all my life, yeah.
You must have shot up because I think your riding career only spanned 7 years, didn't it?
Yeah, I rode, I think, 2 years out of my time, and I was leading rider for both those years, and just went up to about 55 kilos. So that's when I decided to train, yeah.
David, what were the tracks like? I mean, we watch South African racing on television. We see all sorts of different surfaces and different tracks. What were they like back then when you started?
Oh, no, great tracks. Because, when I came here, I mean, Randwick's beautiful and Victoria, Flemington, but all the other tracks I find too tight. You know, in South Africa, every track's like Randwick or even bigger. So they're lovely, lovely tracks. Lovely to ride on and very good on the horse's legs. You know, you don't have much problems with legs there because they're not tight tracks. They're not sweeping corners and long running. So everyone's had his chance. There was no bad luck stories. Very seldom.
I suppose with big sweeping tracks like that, you're not putting that much pressure on horses on turns. And with long run-ins, you've got time to get them balanced up before you actually go for them.
Yeah, you know, when I first got you, I thought, geez, what are these jockeys doing at the 600? They're going 7-6-7 wide, and the horses are on the wrong legs. And anyway, but you've got to do it, because if you don't, you're out of the race.
And, what were the
this is why we got the problems with, a lot of horses go wrong.
With track surfaces there, apart from the grass, did they have dirt or sand or synthetics over there at all?
Yeah, we had sand. Then we went to wood chip. Then we went to synthetic, and we always reverted back to sand. It's funny.
Sand.
Always came back to the sand track. Yeah, they spent millions, and always, you know, we put a synthetic track in, lasted a couple of years, took it out, and went back to sand. It was always the best surface.
What is it about the sand tracks you think that makes it fairer on horses' legs, David?
I think they're more consistent. And what I find here as well, they roll the track too hard. Yeah, the sand track is very hard. And, you know, in South Africa, we had deep, deep sand. So you could gallop horses, get them fit on it. Yeah, they, I don't know, maybe it's because of the timing. They want to time everything, you know, so... You know, when I first got you, I walked into that hut and everybody had a clock around their neck. I thought, my God, what are they doing? Click, click. I went down and said to my wife, I'm out of my depth, yeah.
So instead of rolling the sand, would they harrow it in South Africa?
Yeah, and it was much deeper. Yeah, it would always be harrowed. Beautiful. I mean, you could let a horse run along and they were comfortable. They enjoyed it. And you didn't have to give them that much work because they were heavy. Much heavier. And then if you went to Cape Town, their sand track was just so heavy, it was unbelievable. You thought a horse could never get through it. But they never had problems. Their horses looked well and they won races and never broke down. They never had back trouble. So it worked, yeah. Now, I still think, yeah, with these rolling of the tracks, it's not ideal because horses jar up.
It's
so interesting. You've got to adjust your training.
Interesting what you're saying about the sand, because in Western Australia in particular, you got guys over there, the harness guys, a lot of them train in heavy sand.
Yeah. Oh, no, look, I was a jockey till I rode in it, and it was so much better for horses. You know, it used to be about six inches deep, maybe even a little bit deeper, and horses never had a problem. It was a perfect training surface.
Well, what's fascinating is every time when we get a long wet spell through New South Wales, the subject always bobs up when we lose meetings. Gee, you know, if we had another track we could run on. A sand track, when it gets wet, it just gets firmer, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think it gets like slosh too, so you got to be careful, you know. Yeah.
Would you ever envisage a sand track as a racetrack?
No, it wouldn't be ideal. I prefer turf horses, you know, when they're racing. I think just for getting them fit with sand's perfect.
They used to have a sand track years ago in Brisbane at Albion Park. They called it the creek because Breakfast Creek, a tidal creek, was beside it. And sometimes when a king tide came in, they'd have to delay the races.
Yeah.
Because the water would come in over the track.
Coming over the top, yeah.
Now, you kicked off. You got your career going terrifically well. Some nice horses came along. Naval Escort, Double Eagle. There's a couple that might spring to mind.
Yeah, I rode Naval Escort. He was a top horse. I rode Double Eagle in match races. There were a couple of match races in the old days in South Africa. Yeah, we had he was a champion sprinter, and then there was another champion sprinter, so they challenged each other, and Double Eagle won them both. And then the Johannesburg had a champion sprinter as well, and they challenged as well, so we went up there and we beat them as well. And he was a very good horse, a very good sprinter.
Match racing was something we used to do many years ago. In Victoria, we've had a couple there. I think Letzelope had one day, just a two-horse race at Caulfield, but I can't think of the other horse it was up against. But were match races popular as a betting prospect in South Africa then?
I think it was because, you know, different provinces had their top horses. So when there was a match race between two horses, you know, from different provinces, they used to, the crowd used to come and bet. And they all fancied their horse. But fortunately, mine was far, far superior to most of the horses I raced against.
Now, David, I said you trained over there. You were 24, I think, when you won the July Cup, weren't you?
Yes, yeah, 24. I think still the youngest trainer ever to win it, yeah.
And to win all the Group 1 races, I mean, that's an incredible effort. I think every possible Group 1 in South Africa, you knocked it off.
Yeah, but I had some good clients. You know, I was like Chris Waller. We had good clients, good horses. But where I was fortunate, when I got too heavy, I gave up riding. I was promised horses by quite a few clients. And when I went to approach them, they let me down. So I had to go and ride again. And I rode a winner for this bloke called Norman Ferguson. And he said, I believe you want to train. He said, my train is dying of cancer. You know, come and see me and we'll have a chat. So went to see him, and that's how it started. He gave me 12 horses, private trainer, and in that group was a horse called In Full Flight, which I think really got me going. Mm. He was the best horse in South Africa. Yes, from a two-year-old, just a champion. Absolute freak.
Another great association was a filly, and I believe she was only tiny, Pagoda.
Yeah, Pagoda, yeah. She was a good filly. I think the best filly I had was a filly called Petrava, New Zealand mare. Mm. She won everything. She was an absolute champion. She could sprint a mile. Won all the fillies guineas. Won the a couple of others. I think she won six group ones.
Now, I'm going to refresh your memory with a quote here that you're alleged to have said. Pagoda. Now, she won seven races, was a group one racehorse, and in the words of her trainer, David Payne, she could, quote, catch swallows, or the author says more correctly, she'd have been catching racing pigeons.
Yeah, catch pigeons. that's right, yeah.
You're a bit of a fan of the racing pigeons.
Well, my dad used to race pigeons, and we had to always clean the loft and keep them fit with a flag. You know, you've got to wave them around and around so they don't come and land. So that's how we got involved with pigeons.
How many did your dad have?
Oh, no, he won a lot of races with them. He always used to have about 50 of them. Yeah, with his loft, yep. Mm.
They're a huge sport overseas, aren't they? Worldwide.
They used to race from, just, you know, from Rhodesia to South Africa. That's a long way.
It's true.
And they used to put them from, and in the old days it was called Salisbury. It was one of the capital of Rhodesia, and they used to race them from there. No, it was a big thing there. But the Hawks used to get them as well. You know, used to lose a few.
David, did they ever get up to mischief in the pigeon racing, ring a few in or anything like that?
I don't think you could, yeah, because they all had rings on, you know.
Yeah.
They had the rings that they fitted on their feet. So it was very difficult.
I remember reading an article and I cracked up laughing. It was years ago. Somewhere in England they had one. I don't know what the bloke was giving them, but they reckon he was hitting up the pigeons with some sort of special pigeon feed that was supposed to make him go better.
They wouldn't be dope testing them in those days. So I suppose if you found something, you could use it.
bit hard to take a swab, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah.
Now, South Africa, as I said, you had the terrific career there. What was the decision behind coming to Australia? Why did you decide to move?
Well, I used to always come to the New Zealand sale every year from about 1970 and buy horses and take them back. And I got to know quite a few people. And then a couple of my mates emigrated to Australia. Oh, but in the early 90s.
Mm.
And, you know, so I pop over here and see them. And then one day my daughter said, "Dad, why don't we emigrate?" So I said, "No, I'm a bit old for that. I was 54 years old." So anyway, eventually she kept on. And I said, "Oh, we'll apply." So we applied to come here, but they said, "You're too old." So anyway, they said, "What's your record? Can we see your racing record?" Mm. And that's how I got in. They were taking, I think, about 12 people on special visas, sort of, what do they call it? Anyway, there were special visas to come in. And that's how I got in, just lucky. Yeah.
Now, I'm chin-wagging with David Payne. David, after Ace High won the Victoria Derby, I was watching something this morning on YouTube, and there was a quote there, and you said to Bruce McAvaney, when he interviewed you after the race, he said, "I should have come here 40 years ago."
Well, I would have, because I would have been a young man then. And then, you know, but when you got a great string in South Africa and you do well, you're winning everything, you don't even think about leaving the country.
Mm.
But in retrospect, I should have, you know, because I would have been a young man coming here, and I think I could have had more of a chance, more of an opportunity.
Well, you came with your wife and children. You now have grandchildren here in Australia. Was leaving South Africa, was safety a concern over there for kids growing up?
Yes, that's was the main reason, political, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely that, because the kids, we still, you know, used to go out at night and you never slept until they knocked on, you know, they opened the front door. So it was, we used to always worry. Every night was, you were stressed out if they went out.
I've got a mate who came out, and I'm not sure, 100% sure where he came from, the town, but and I don't want to name one for fear of being wrong, but he said it was just incredible the change in life leaving there to come here where we lived in South Africa. He said we had high fences with electric wires on top, and he said we basically lived in like a fortress almost.
100%, yeah. And I used to carry a gun with me everywhere I went because, you know, when, especially going early in the morning to work, so I always had a gun strapped on my leg. And whenever we went out at night, there was a gun with us. Because if you broke down, you were always worried, you know, that you'd be hijacked. Or And unfortunately, they didn't just hijack you, they shot you most times.
So, well, this guy, the point he made, I'll be interested in your reaction to this. He said he'd been here for probably 12 months, 2 years. He worked at a recording studio and we used to do voiceovers. And we were chatting one day and he said he had a real reality check when he rang a mate up, back his neighbour, back in South Africa to wish him a Merry Christmas. And the bloke said, you wouldn't believe what happened. He'd painted this, you know, the massive fence out the front. He said, I've painted it all and the whole lot. And he said, these idiots have come past the other day with a semi-automatic machine gun and blasted into the fence. And he said he realised what a change in his life had been when he got a shock. The bloke's reaction was it wasn't so much that the blokes were firing a semi-automatic machine gun at his fence. It was the fact that he had to go and paint it again.
Yeah, I know. Well, you get used to it, you know. Once you're living in that situation, I used to have a small home, 25 acres, electric fence all the way around. And a couple of times a week, the alarm would go off, so I'd grab the shotgun with my guard dogs. I had a couple of Alsatians, get in the truck, drive down, and they used to cut through the fence and pinch your paddock poles. And man, but you used to get used to it, you know, it was sort of part of your life.
It must have been, as you said, difficult when you're there and looking at your children and thinking, do I want my children to grow up in this environment?
Yeah, no, that's, and, you know, when we first applied, they said my son couldn't come in because he was working, so we had to leave him behind, and it took him 3 years to get here, so we were worried about that as well. And one day, unfortunately, three Africans approached him and they wanted money from him, and he said no, and they stabbed him with a syringe. So he was on that AIDS antiviral stuff. So, we were worried as well. We nearly went back, actually, because we thought, no, he can't get in. He can't get in, you know, on his own. So, but thank God, eventually, he got in.
This must seem pretty easy here now.
Oh, I tell you, you don't have to lock doors. I mean, my wife often says, gee, you know, so you're not stressed anymore. Because, you know, even when we go back, we walking down the road and you see a couple of people walking towards you and you start worrying, especially if they're all males. You know, you don't know if they're going to grab you. So it's pretty stressful.
Mm. Looking at the brightest day, Victoria Derby, ace high, Ty England, things just didn't quite go to plan. He had to pull out and park up three or four wide without a bit of cover. And you must have been gnashing your teeth thinking, what's going to happen here? But he knew what he was doing.
Well, it was funny. You know, I was actually standing watching the TV in the parade ring. And I was looking and I thought, oh, my God. When I saw it happen, I actually started walking away. I thought, well, he's gone. He can't win. But anyway, thank God he had the ability.
He was the one you wanted. I mean, you'd had a couple of cracks before, Criterion, Honorius, Posito.
Yes, you know, we had a crack, and I said to originally John didn't want to go for it. He said, no, he said, I don't want to go for the Derby because I want a stallion. So I said, gee, John, this is the right horse for it. Anyway, he said, I'm not really keen, but he eventually I spoke him into it. I said, you've got to have a crack, you know. I said, anyway, so he agreed.
So now, afterwards, an old mate walked over and congratulated you. You must have had a smile on your face and turned around. Lester Piggott was there.
Yeah, Lester, we used to ride together. A lovely chap, Lester. And a funny story was I was a stable jockey to his cousin, Fred Rickaby.
Yeah,
that's how we got to know Lester well. Fred Rickaby trained in South Africa. There was Bill Rickaby and Fred. They were cousins of Lester's. Great trainers and great jockeys as well in the old days.
Now, you'll be able to tell us, because Lester did do a little stint in the big house for tax evasion, but they reckon he had his second quid. He spent the first one buying a wallet to put it all in.
Yeah, oh, he served time, old Lester. I think he had a suitcase and they confiscated it at the airport. It was quite a bit of money in it.
Yes. He went inside and got the stripes unturned for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, oh, he's a character, old Lester.
What was it about him that made him such a great rider? Because he was a tall jockey.
Great judge. Gee, he could. He never made a mistake with picking a ride. Two in the race, you know, like Chris Waller would have, say, five runners. You'd guaranteed pick the right one every time. Mm. Unbelievable. And there were group races, two overseas. And he just had that balance. You know, he used to sit much shorter than everybody else. But he was just powerful and balanced, just an athlete.
And that was the thing, wasn't it? He rode so short at that stage, even when they did ride short. Frankie's father, and all those, he used to ride unbelievably short, but he rode short, but he was such a tall rider. As you said, his balance must have been unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I rode with Frankie's father as well, and he was a little bloke. So, you know, he could sit short, but Lester, I mean, you'd think he'd fall off, but gee, he was so well balanced and hard to beat in the finish as well. Just to pick
now,
him up.
When you look at Frankie's dad's saddle, have you ever seen anyone ride with shorter leathers?
No, unbelievable. Yeah.
I remember seeing one of his saddles in invitation meeting one day, and he'd run out of holes on the leathers, and he'd actually had to wrap them around the top of the stirrup a couple of times as well to get them up short enough.
Yeah. No, that was him. Yeah. But he was a tiny bloke, Cozzy. If you stood next to him, he was a shorty. Now, I've still got a photo in my office of him and all the blokes that we rode with.
Now,
brings back memories.
David, one of the things, and I'm chin-wagging with David Payne, one of the things you've been an advocate for is that with our programming of races, particularly with babies, two-year-olds, you get these days we're getting some, you know, your high chaparrals and these that are bred to get a bit of ground, that perhaps later in the season we should start programming races that are longer than, say, 1,600.
Definitely. You know, if you look at, you see, they all program around the slippery. Unfortunately, so you'll see up right up until the slipper, they don't usually go past 1,200 metres.
Yep.
And there's a lot of horses sitting in the boxes that should be racing, and it's very difficult for a young horse to take on older horses. As you see, if they're not above average, you can put a three-year-old against four- and five-year-olds in a maiden, and it's not the ability that beats them, it's the toughness. And they don't give them much weight for age relief here, which I can't understand. In South Africa, we do. So if you've got a staying horse and he's not above average, you've just got to put him in the paddock and wait until he matures.
With a lot of babies who are staying bred, if for example, towards the end of a season, you had your 1,600, 1,800, even 2,000-metre races, would you give them like a prep, not run them, tip them out, and then bring them back and give them that prep, a second prep, to have them ready at the end of the season, or would you run them earlier?
Yes. No, I'd run them early. If they want to run, you can run them. We used to do it in South Africa. It was never an issue. But they did put them on you, Cozzy, in the old day, you know, a couple of years ago. Mm. But they didn't support it. The trainers never supported it. So you'd get three, four runners. They bagged it again.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you see that situation, then every Melbourne Cup where everyone bleeds and says, oh, why aren't the Aussie horses in there? There's a real good reason why.
For sure, you know, I won the one with Honorius and Oracle Bomber Brown. Honorius went on, he was a two-year-old. I mean, he ran in derbies and races like that, and he raced until he was 6 years old or 7 years old. So it was never an issue that it was too early for him. You know, they just bred to stay. So, but unfortunately, I don't think they're going to change now.
Mm. Now, David, these days in the camp, it's coming onto the new year. People have got the bills to pay after Christmas. We're obviously on the snip for a winner as well. You've got Reagan in on Saturday at Randwick and Declan McDonough, that very good Irish rider.
Yeah, nice colt. He's going to be all right, but might be a bit early for him, Cozzy, but he'll be competitive. Mm-hmm. He'll be thereabouts, but I think, you know, the others might have the wood on him because they're a bit more mature and they've had a couple of runs under their belt.
All right. What about New Year's Day? Colesberg, Stella Victoria, Little L? No, Little L scratched.
Yeah, he scratched. I think Stella Victoria could be another one. She was a little bit unlucky the other day.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned your love of the pigeons and the racing. Something that goes very well with pigeon is wine, and I believe you don't mind the odd nice wine as well.
I don't mind a drop of red. I love it.
So,
that's my one vase. Yeah, my wife doesn't agree with me. She gives me that look when I have a bit of red.
The bit of red? favorite, where do you head to? Where's your favourite spot in Australia for a red, or have you never found a bad one like me?
Oh, no. I love the Barossa. You know, the McLaren Vale and all the cab sabs from Western Australia. So I've worked it out.
You've done a bit of a barrier trial on a few. A little bit of homework.
A little bit of tasting.
I've never struck a bad one yet. I reckon if I've got crook, it must have been a dirty glass, David.
Look, the wines are excellent. Yeah. Terrific. You can't go far wrong.
No, exactly. Well, let's hope you get to enjoy one for New Year and celebrate. It's been fantastic having a chinwag with you this morning. Thanks. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. And have a great New Year and hope all and health and happiness to you and your family.
Terrific, mate. All the best and good luck for 2018.
Thanks, Cozzy.